Today, we look at America's gun debate after nearly 20,000 people were killed in shootings in 2020, a huge increase compared to the year before. How aware were you of gun violence as a child?
I was always aware, honestly. I remember being in elementary school, maybe 7 or 8, maybe even younger. And my family decided to get double-paned windows because a bullet flew through.
My goodness, flew through the window.
Yeah. Well, it almost got into the house. It just punctured and made a big, like, a crack throughout the window. It was just the thing, you know? We would even, if we saw a car making a U-turn down our street to go back the other way, we would play a game and we'd call it literally drive-by. Jump behind cars and pretend like, oh, it's a drive-by. Like, but you're outside playing. After that, it got a bit more serious because then you actually start to see friends and peers affected by gun violence. It was something that I always knew was a thing. I just always knew that people who looked like me and my friends got shot.
Abhinay Clayton is a reporter on the Guardian's Guns and Lies in America project. Since her childhood in Richmond, California, she's been acutely aware of the impact of gun violence on communities. Not the high-profile mass shootings that make it onto news bulletins across the world, but everyday incidents that rarely make the national news. And yet, according to Abhinay, it is these shootings that are driving America's gun violence crisis. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, why so much about America's gun debate is wrong. I mean, thinking back to that now as an adult, the idea of playing a game like that and saying, oh, it's a drive-by and, you know, something that you thought was hilarious probably as a kid, what does that make you think now?
Honestly, I hadn't thought about it until this conversation, and it makes me realize how not normal that is. And it makes me realize how acceptable people may think it is because there are young Black kids playing these games. I think it just contributes to this idea that I'm able to write about clearly now, the idea that this is just what happens in the hood. This is a normal part of life when it absolutely isn't. And me and my friends should never have even had the idea to play a game called drive-by.
You said this was something that happened in the hood, and you said that this was something that happened to people who looked like me. What did you mean by those two things?
Well, I was raised in a solely like Black and Latino community. I honestly didn't really meet a white person or go to school with a white person until I was in middle school. So everyone I knew was either Black or Latino. And when I watched TV, when I watched the news, those were the faces that I saw coming up. Those were the people that I saw on RIP t-shirts. So that was just always my understanding, that it's the people who look like me who get shot. And my community, I live in the south side of Richmond, and my exact neighborhood was this really interesting, like, cul-de-sac that was in some ways sequestered from some of the more troubled parts of the city. But I was around it, you know, in my backyard was a low-income, like, housing project where so many of my friends are from. But my parents wouldn't let me go over there.
Did your parents ever talk to you about guns?
Not explicitly. I do remember one day asking my mom, I was like, Mom, do we live in the hood? I just had felt like my experiences, my concept of the hood was these, you know, John Singleton movies and these very gritty crime dramas. And that was so different from my personal experience. I had both my parents. Neither of my parents were like on drugs or any of these kind of like stereotypes. So it just didn't seem to mesh. But she was like, yeah, obviously you live in the hood, you know? And that kind of was a real turning point for me to realize, like, oh, this is my community and I have every right to love it here. And I have every right to love the people that I am around. You know, being from or in the hood isn't a negative thing because this is the community that raised me.
You decided to become a journalist and began working on a local newspaper. What did you find yourself writing about? Did it often come back to guns?
So something that was a regular refrain, whether we were talking about, you know, healthy foods, a urban garden, a new co-working art space, it would all come down to reducing gun violence. You know, what can we do? How can we use these city funds? How can we work in the schools to make sure that our Black and brown young people are alive and free? I started to meet people who were affected by gun violence, who had had their children killed, who had had their brothers killed. I learned that these stories are worth telling. They're not just these local incidents. They can tell us a lot about our nation, and they're valuable. And the people who live in these communities that are most affected are the experts on the matter. You don't need to reach out to a criminologist at Harvard to understand the toll and the reasons behind gun violence in urban communities. These people, folks have the answers already. They know what's going on. They've been living it. No one has spoken to them is the only thing.
You know, in the last few weeks, it seems like there's been back-to-back mass shootings. Atlanta, Georgia.
Police say all four victims who were shot and killed at the second and third locations appeared to be Asian women.
Boulder, Colorado.
King Super's grocery store. That is where the bloodshed took place yesterday when...
South Carolina.
At least five people were killed during this mass shooting at a home in York County, South Carolina, most of them from the same family.
But from what you're saying, behind every one of those stories will have been so many more. In your experience, what are the stories that get coverage and what are those that don't?
So the shootings that you're referring to, I like to call them high-profile mass shootings, the ones that get a lot of news attention and are in these public spaces, and they're less than 1% of all gun deaths in the nation. They're about 0.2. And most gun deaths in the U.S. are from suicides. And then after that are the kind of community and street level violent situations that I write about. The stories that end up becoming national headlines and are mass shootings or mass casualty events are the ones that happen usually in public places, which adds to a level of surprise and unexpectedness. There's this idea that, oh, I could have been there. I go to the grocery store all the time. I'm always in the mall. I send my kid to school. There are these places that most Americans can say, I have been in that exact same place. And often the person who has done the shooting fits a certain kind of lone wolf profile. Maybe they had been, you know, perhaps radicalized somewhere. There may be a connection to some other sort of extremism issue, which kind of adds to the newsworthiness of it oftentimes. And so these are the ones that get the most attention. These are the ones that precede calls for universal background checks and are the ones that kickstart legislation into motion.
And what are the ones that people aren't thinking about or talking about?
Yeah. Well, those are the ones that happen in places where your average, perhaps, suburbanite may say, oh, I would never be there. Don't they know that people always get shot in those neighborhoods? I simply can't relate to anything going on there. The ones that usually involve Black and brown young people, usually young boys and men. The ones that are relegated to just local crime coverage. So it becomes kind of a white noise in the background, whereas these more high-profile mass shootings are pushed to the front. But it just goes back to seeing local and community gun violence as a byproduct of living in a low-income, majority person of color neighborhood. People truly believe that this is just what happens. It's natural, it's normal, when in fact it's not, and it's just as devastating.
There was a story you covered shortly after you started writing for The Guardian that really underlines those divisions, where there were multiple casualties in a place that lots of people could imagine being at, a party. Tell me what happened.
It was the night of Halloween in 2019, and I was just scrolling through social media, and I started to see some RIP messages. I started to see people post about a shooting that had happened, imploring folks to check on their loved ones and all of that. And I didn't think much of it. I just kind of went to sleep and was like, damn, someone else got shot. That's sad. You know, I'll see what's going on when I wake up. I wake up to see a high school classmate of mine post that she's just happy to be alive, that she's had a horrifically scary night. And from then, I just started to see all the news reports.
We have to start with this breaking news story that somebody has opened fire at a Halloween party overnight near San Francisco, and police say that four people were killed. Do you see how people are helping other people out who could have been injured? And some were seen just sitting on the street crying.
It was all over the national news. Local news was, of course, all over it, but it was on places like NBC.
We do know that at least some of the victims were brought here to Walnut Creek, to John Muir Medical Center, to the trauma center where they specialize in this sort of thing.
I came into the office that day and mentioned it during our morning meeting. After the meeting, I was still looking through Facebook when I saw the name. His name was Omar, another high school classmate of mine. That's when I realized that he had been shot and killed at that party. Of course, we have a bunch of mutual friends on Facebook, so there are a lot of folks that I knew and cared about who were distressed and heartbroken.
Was he young?
He was. He was in his early 20s, and he had a young daughter, and he was DJing the party. He DJed to support his young family. And when the shooting started, he got hit. It was just a horrifically sad situation all around. In the days following, the identities of both the suspected gunmen as well as the victims came out.
Police say the shooting killed five people. The youngest victim, 19-year-old Oceana Tompkins.
And they were all Black and in their 20s and teens.
Omar Taylor, Tyon Farley, Javeen County, and Ramon Hill Jr.
Then there was a decided shift in the tone of coverage. It was no longer a national news story. It was no longer a mass shooting on par with Parkland. It was a gang shooting. It was a local crime story then. And that really, really bothered me. It was very distressing to see the definition of a mass shooting be warped in real time. And I wrote about it. You know, I wrote about this change in tone after we realized who the victims were and how we treat Black lives that are taken by gun violence versus how we treat white ones that are taken by gun violence. We would still be talking about it. There would be a foundation in those children's names. But we don't extend that same care to the young people who died and were injured and had their lives upended by that shooting in Orinda. And that's really when I realized that the way we talk about gun violence and mass shootings is wrong.
Can you tell me what this looks like in numbers? How many people are killed by shootings in America each year? And how much did that increase last year?
So in 2020, there was about a 25% increase in gun homicides in the U.S., which translates to a bit over 19,000 people who have been killed, which is around 4,000 additional murders than we've seen in the year before. Beginning in the weeks and months that followed the initial shutdowns of businesses and of schools and community centers, cities, big and small, from Oakland to Lubbock, Texas, started to see gun violence start to tick upwards. And cities that had been experiencing record lows started to break new records for highs. Los Angeles, there's an 11-year high in shootings. There was over 300 homicides last year. And mass shootings on city streets have increased as well.
What do we know about the victims of these deaths and the circumstances?
Yeah, that's one of the toughest parts, because so often we don't know anything about them besides they were a man shot on X block in X city, you know? Very rarely do we get to hear from the families or even know the names of people who have been killed besides, you know, the occasional Facebook post or seeing things on Instagram. It's usually quite rare that in a news story you'll see the name. Maybe in a local news story they'll go to a vigil or something, but it's quite rare and has been even more rare, I feel, in 2020, just with the sheer number of people who are shot and killed each week. It's hard to keep up with.
Do we know any more about the perpetrators?
Rarely. I mean, in most police departments, from my understanding, having a 30% clearance rate, about 1 in 3 murders solved, is highly successful. So most people know nothing about who's murdered their child, loved one, father, cousin, sister, aunt. People end up having no answers and no closure in the legal sense.
Why? Why is it so difficult to get a full picture?
Well, there are very few homicide detectives in a department often, and guns are often used in murders because you can shoot somebody from a far distance. You know, you can shoot somebody from a car, and all that's left are perhaps bullet fragments that are hard to trace back to a gun. And even if they do trace it back to a gun, it's quite unlikely that it's a registered firearm to the person who did the shooting. Sometimes it's hard to get witness statements. So there's a plethora of reasons why these homicides, no one ever gets answers. And that's the reality for most people.
What does it mean for the overall debate and for our understanding of gun violence that the focus is so skewed?
I think when all of our attention and therefore all of the resources and legislative efforts go toward the rarest form of gun violence, which are high-profile mass shootings, it completely obscures the reality of the situation. And it takes away necessary attention, focus, and care from the communities that have always gotten the shortest end of the stick, you know? I'll give you an example. After the Atlanta shooting, a very popular sentiment was, oh my gosh, gun violence is back. See, we're getting these vaccinations. People are going back to their normal lives. And of course, the shooting starts up again. And the privilege that is dripping from those words to have experienced any sort of reprieve from gun violence is just astonishing to me, because I know, and so many others know, that communities have been hit worse. People are doing bad right now. Folks are getting shot left and right. So to see people say that this new gun violence is back, it's back on the upswing, it just is so kind of disrespectful and dismissive of the people who have been losing loved ones, sometimes multiple people in a family, since March 2020. People who have had to try to bury their loved ones when they can only have 10 people at a funeral. Folks who have had to identify their children's bodies over Zoom. It completely dismisses everything that those folks have gone through, all because the U.S. focuses on the type of gun violence that affects people that we don't expect it to.
Why is it that rates increased during the pandemic?
Everyone does not have a home where they can be safe and quarantine and work from home, you know, and those economic issues that existed long before the pandemic were exacerbated. And a lot of violence interrupters, usually formerly incarcerated folks who may have been involved in the street life, may have been shooters or were shot, weren't able to do their jobs the same way. These skilled workers go into communities, go into schools, do house checks. It's that in-person interaction. It's the hugs. It's the looking in the eyes. It's the being on the same level that you can't replicate over Zoom. So a lot of ground was lost there. And I mean, the loss of schools has just been absolutely detrimental to teenagers. I've talked to violence interrupters who, when they look back on the year 2020, they talk about how the kind of profile they have of a would-be shooter has expanded now beyond that 19 to 29 at-risk age range to include kids as young as 14, you know, who aren't going to Zoom school, whose parents may be working, and they're out, you know, they're out on the streets. And that makes them more at risk of being either shot or doing the shooting themselves.
What you're describing sounds like a systemic problem. Do we have an understanding of the causes?
I think that generational trauma is very real, you know, unaddressed trauma especially. People don't realize the stress that you hold in your body when you live in a city or live in a neighborhood where you hear gunshots regularly. People don't understand how that can affect the way you think, the way you may value yourself. You know, if all you see are your friends and your uncles and people who look like you being shot and killed or being sent to prison for decades for gun crimes, if that's all you see, then it's less likely that you're gonna find value and worth and potential in yourself. And if you don't see that in yourself, how are you going to extend that to someone else, which makes it easier to get a gun? Often, you know, young folks get a gun for protection and they end up using it. And then when you couple that with perhaps going to a school that's severely under-resourced, where you don't have certain programs, they may not be able to afford contracts to bring in violence interrupters or even bring in people who can teach the kids about music and just show them that there is potential and that they have a life worth living and that they are a necessity to their communities. There very rarely are few people who young people who are at risk can identify with telling them these things. You know, you may hear it from your parents and from the people who love you, but hearing it from somebody who has walked the same path as you is so valuable. And some people get it automatically by virtue of where they're born and who their family is. But for others, they never get it. Their parents may have never have gotten it. The people they live around may not get it. So what are folks left to do besides repeat the patterns that they've seen laid out ahead of them?
Coming up, what can be done to break this tragic pattern of gun violence? Abhinay, what you've described is so shocking. Almost 20,000 deaths in a year. Clearly it needs urgent action, like you've described, on a community level. But instead, so much of the focus is on these high-profile mass shootings. Where has that led America in terms of the solutions being discussed?
You know, you get universal background checks, assault weapons bans, magazine capacity limits, and all these things that people want. And that would address very little. Even in states like California, where we have some of the strictest gun laws, you can't have a clip, which is like the container with the bullets in it, in a gun, you can't have more than 10 bullets in there. But there are all these modifications that people can make to make it more deadly and more automatic. The restrictions we have done not that much to curb gun violence. So I'm always really wary of the amount of attention that we put on the politics and the partisan issues that stop gun legislation from coming through, because what we really need is money funneled into communities. Most guns that people use are already illegal. It's already illegal to shoot somebody, you know? So it is worrying that so much focus continues to go to these knee-jerk reactions, which could be valuable. I certainly don't want to diminish the value of anything that people hope will save lives and keep guns out of the hands of folks who plan to do harm. But it's worrying that that's where all of the attention has gone.
I guess a lot of this comes down to state legislation. But on a federal level, a positive point for campaigners is the new president, Joe Biden, who just last month, in the aftermath of a mass shooting, used a speech to highlight exactly what you're talking about.
Our flag was still flying at half staff for the victims of the horrific murder of 8 primarily Asian American people in Georgia, when 10 more lives were taken in a mass murder in Colorado. You probably didn't hear it, but between those two incidents, less than 1 week apart, there were more than 850 additional shootings.
So what's he done? What's he going to do?
In the past couple of months, it's been encouraging to see some movement and attention on the federal level, which is something I've never seen before. He included $5 billion for specifically community violence intervention programs in his infrastructure bill. And the White House announced executive actions on gun violence. And one of those actions was specifically earmarked for community gun violence that affects mostly Black and brown young folks. So it's been encouraging to see, and it's unfortunate that it's so unprecedented when this issue has been with us for so long. But just that acknowledgement on the federal level that gun violence in America is more than acts of extremism, is more than high-profile mass shootings, is, I think, a step in the right direction. But it still remains to be seen how much the funds will actually translate into real change. The infrastructure bill has to pass first. And even with these executive actions, I think they total about $230 million or so for local gun violence prevention groups. And that is just, it's just not enough. And this money would need to go not just towards gun violence intervention, but it needs to also go to schools, you know, and all kind of different places that interact with young folks. So there's a lot of work to be done, but I think that the Biden administration's mind and heart is in the right place. I will definitely say that.
Thank you so much.
Of course.
That was Abhinay Clayton, who has, along with Lois Beckett and others at The Guardian, been writing for the ongoing Guns and Lies series. You can find it at theguardian.com. There is some brilliant reporting in there. And I'd recommend one piece by Abhinay and Lois together called Everything About America's Gun Debate Is Wrong. Here's why. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Elizabeth Cassin. Sound design was by Nicholas Alexander. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.